Welcome to Emotional Sobriety, the next step in recovery with Dr. Alan Berger and Tom Rutledge. Hey, so how's your horse?
He's better. He's getting some treatment that is helping. You know, they get old, and it's kind of an ongoing treatment thing. So they're getting some. He's getting some shots and stuff. So we will see. But he's okay for now.
One of my editing clients has a horse in a stable called Portuguese Bend out here. I've been trying to go every 2 weeks and walk him and learn about horsemanship.
Cool.
And I might ride him eventually, but I've just really been enjoying spending time with him. And you have how many horses?
We just have two now. We had to put one of them down about 6 months ago. So we're down as low as we've been for a long time. Yeah. People don't have patience to do the work on the ground. I mean, everybody wants to get on top of the horse. It's like you're doing the right thing to get to know, just to get to manage the horse on the ground. That's the most important thing.
Well, that's what she tells me, is because she's Michelle is the horse's owner. Mm-hmm. And she's been, you know, riding and doing professional, you know, this thing professionally since she was a girl. And she said that everything that you need to know about moving when you're on top of the horse, you know, it's like you're doing the same thing on the ground. You know, it's the same, similar kind of.
Well, it's all relationship. It's all very much like what Dee Dee does with equine therapy. You're basically working out your relationship, and there's lots of things that are in common with all horses. But the other thing any good horse person is going to tell you is, you know, don't ever think because you've handled one or two or three or four horses, you handle the next one. It's like it's just like people. You gotta get to know them personally. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, it's fun. I had to get myself stepped on a few times before I could learn anything.
Those are the injuries you've incurred from the horses. So you got stepped on a couple times.
I've gotten stepped on. Yeah, I got stepped on. It's like, well, I mean, the biggest injury I had was when my horse spun around and kicked me in the stomach. But I've heard a little bit when I've come off the horse. So, you know, and I mean, you know, basically I would have probably said I was bucked off a horse when I was younger, but I was really, I just was falling off because the horse was moving. But I've only been bucked off a horse one time. It was a mule, actually.
When you got kicked in the stomach, did you do the positive reframe? At least it wasn't my nuts.
Well, actually, yeah. I mean, it happened on Christmas Eve. We call it our Christmas of gratitude, and the trauma surgeon who saw me in the emergency room, he said, the next day when he'd come back to see me, he said, you know, if you're going to get kicked in the stomach by a horse, or you're going to kick by a horse, he said, you got kicked in the exact right space. You know, he said a little bit higher hit your heart, you're gone. You know, a little bit lower or a little bit harder, he would have torn up your intestines. It's like so all I got was a bruise I had to sit there in the hospital with for 3 or 4 days.
We've got the OG Emotional Sobriety Wrecking Crew here today. We've got Tom, Tom and Alan. And I just want to, before we get going, I just want to let everyone know that in two episodes, I think this episode and then the next one, we will have recorded 200 episodes of the show, which is
really
exciting. 200, yeah. And I'm super proud of all of them. And
well, that's cool. To put it in perspective, with Start Right Here, the first podcast we did 40 episodes. Yeah. So we've done 200 of these. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. And I've got some ideas for, you know, guests, you know, we can talk to in the future, and kind of like new wrinkles we can explore in the emotional sobriety concept. Wow. So, yeah.
Well,
I
think the way we used to say it with the first podcast, too, was the idea, you know, if we keep doing it, we'll figure out how to do it.
Yeah. I like whenever anybody hits me with the field of dreams, you know, if you build it, they will come, you know. And so we've been building.
Well, I mean, truly with gratitude, I can say we keep showing up. We, the three of us have, we identified a long time ago that this is therapy for us. This is our own little group to come together, and we come to depend on that. But it's also just, you know, I mean, I'm not saying we don't know what we're doing, because we do stuff, but this is a cool thing, way to do with podcasts, is there is a sense of fly by the seat of your pants kind of spontaneity that goes with it. And I love the opportunity for us to do that with the three of us, sometimes with other guests that we have, but especially with Joe, because he's just one of us. And Carol, same thing. So, and I just appreciate listeners who've been, and I hear from listeners quite a bit who tune in, and I'm just very grateful. I think it's really a language thing that kind of helped me tune into this. And I've been talking to people about streamlining your thinking. What I mean by that is going back to this thing that has really struck me in the last few years of doing this, the emotional sobriety work. Change the things you can, you know, accept the things you can. That means don't try to change the things you can't. Okay, now that seems obvious, but I don't think that's always been obvious to me. I think that was a definition of a struggle that I had on a regular basis, is I would wrestle with the things I can't change, and then eventually come to the place, sometimes sooner than later, but I'd get to a place where I've got to accept that I can't change it. And so acceptance, and maybe Roger had a lot to do with this change too, because the acceptance was kind of a resignation in that way. And Roger with the Nathaniel Brandon stuff, Roger brought into us, to me for sure, the idea that acceptance, a reframe of acceptance. Acceptance is the way he put it, is the first step to change always. You know, and so before I had it as a punctuation, you know, okay, you know, and a positive thing, but it's still resignation. All right, I give up. I'm going to do that. And, you know, and basically what I got from Roger is no, that you can't move to whatever's next unless you fully, completely accept what is now. And so that part taken literally, but the other piece that probably more than anything else is, rather than just beginning the day with the serenity prayer itself, put your energy where it can count.
I love that. Boil it all down. The reduced.
I wake up every morning and remind myself, I got a list of reminders, remind myself, I only control me, and I only control part of me. Okay, I don't control my physical self. I can now, by the way, make the distinction here as I say all this, that between influence and control. You know, we influence others in other situations, but by focusing on ourselves. That's a big piece of what emotional sobriety is, as far as I'm concerned. Wake up and I say, okay, I don't control anything other than my mind, and only two parts of my mind. The part of me that the rational, conscious part of me that perceives and interprets the world. When you say the problem is not the problem, it's like what we're responding to is our interpretation of what's going on. Sometimes people get a little defensive, I think, and go, well, well, you're telling me my interpretation is wrong. No, I'm just telling you, you know, that's what we have to work off of. It's all we have is our interpretation. And then the other thing we can control is how we respond to what's happening, our behavioral response, but also our conscious mental response. And here's the streamlined part. What I've been noticing, and I'd be interested in y'all's take on this, what I've been noticing is that when I really take this absolutely literally, which translates to, once I identify, once something falls in the category of something I do not have control over, don't do anything. Stop doing it. If you determine something can't be done, stop trying to do it, you know? And I mean, just think about how often we hit our heads on brick walls.
Well, right. And the log jam with that is like, we ask ourselves, well, who am I if I can't get this done? If I can't do this thing?
Yeah, identity. Right. Yeah. Absolutely. It goes to our worth and our identity. And the truth is where I want to feel better. And Patrick, you and I have talked about this before. It's like, how much of our identity now also comes from our ability to be humble. But I can honestly say, I don't mind admitting I'm wrong. you know, I don't mind. And that's a lot of, use your freedom, your term, Alan, that's freedom.
You would have been happy at the meeting, at my meeting the other day, a guy brought up Marcus Aurelius and the anecdote in Meditations about the, somebody would walk around with him and basically tell him, whisper in his ear that he's just a man, you know, throughout, right? Keeping him humble, you know, throughout every day, even though he's the Lord
Marcus
of all creation.
Marcus Aurelius is a great example of that because he was the emperor of Rome. He was the most powerful man in the world, and the whole thing about his meditations, the book Meditations. He didn't write that for publication. He didn't write that for anything else. The thing that's so fucking wonderful about that book is every note in that book were written to himself. You know, it's his reflections, his reminders to himself. And it's like, yeah, I don't know. I don't know that we'll see another person like that in the government.
Well, hey, Tom, you know, it makes me wonder what you have rattling around that's unpublished. When will the world see your Meditations?
I'm still doing some back and forth procrastinating with my Sit Down and Shut Up book, which is my favorite book I've ever written. So it's like, because I wrote it kind of accidentally and I didn't have anybody I was writing it for. I just wrote it. So I'm really close to that. Alan and I are still working separately on our One Day at a Time book for emotional sobriety. And I like that book. It's like, we haven't met about it for a long time, Alan, but I've gotten, you know, you probably have too. I've got different ideas since we last met and things. And really, but I love just the pieces that I've written, the pieces I have. When we first started, we were sharing stuff. So I saw some of what you had too. And it's like, I just think this is going to be a great book too. Yeah. So, but anyway, basically, so I'll let you guys chime in here. But the streamline your thinking or my thinking is simply to say I'm going to do my best to live by a rule that says once I identify, even if I have to do it every single day, once I identify that I cannot control something, you know, or this is all I can control about that, then I stop putting additional energy into it. I'm working on procrastination a lot, you know, and I put it off a lot too, but it's like, if I get up, okay, we're talking about the book. Okay, if we're talking about the Sit Down and Shut Up book that I need to be working on to finish up because I'm really close. I used to go through the process of spending all day long going back and forth saying, oh, I should be doing that, like that. But the truth is, I'm either going to work on it today or I'm not, period. So I just need to be honest with myself. And what I realized actually just this morning was I've been running con jobs on myself, just like I used to with professors when I was telling them why I had to turn in paper in late. You know, I mean, you know, the wonderful stories we would invent by that. And I realized I'm doing that to myself and it's a waste of energy. You know, either I'm going to work on that book today and maybe I would think I won't and then I will. But it's like processing it to myself, thinking it back and forth, criticizing myself is a waste of time.
It's very interesting to think about streamlining it. You know, you used to talk about, which I really appreciated the discussion we had about, that we start out with a conscious incompetence.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Really unconscious incompetence.
Or unconscious incompetence. Yeah. Yeah. We don't know what we're doing and we don't know that. Yeah.
And then we become conscious of it. And then we start to focus on it consciously.
Yes.
So I recall when I was starting karate training and that the emphasis was you're going to practice a front punch. It doesn't change from one front punch to another. It's just that you're going to do it so many times that it becomes automatic.
Yeah.
That when you're in a situation, you won't have to think about it. It will be available to you automatically because you've trained so hard. And that was the same within the Marine Corps. We would train certain drills in terms of, you know, if we got hit in this way, our response to it would be. And so what you're talking about emotional sobriety, it's very similar. It's like when we practice this, and that's why whenever you brought in the idea, Tom, that emotional sobriety, at the heart of it, there has to be a discipline of practicing the concept.
Yeah.
We need to make that conscious. We need to be able to say, hey, I'm upset. What's going on with me? And to be able to start to unpack our disturbances. Well, eventually, when you do that enough times, automatically, when you're going to get upset, you're going to go, oh, I know what this is.
Yeah.
Right? I got an expectation.
Yeah, and you're actually, and that's the learning thing. You're actually not going to even go through a conscious cognitive process. I mean, I love your front punch thing, because what they're doing, they're teaching you to do that. So, we can mix our metaphors. Even somebody learned to play the piano. You know, it's like, you know, what can you, or you play the guitar, it's like, or the bass. And it's like, I mean, you know, you can do things without thinking about it that I couldn't do if I'd have to start from scratch. But no, it's like, only through practice does that. Repetitious practice, not just a little bit of practice.
Right. And then the first step is we have to be aware that we're doing it. We have to be aware that, you know, we keep trying to change something that can't be changed. Alcoholism helps with that.
What we learned to let go sooner is what it is. Rather than say, I've done that before in my life, beat myself up because I'm still going back and holding on to something. It's like, well, that's a waste of energy too. Just as soon as you, you know, anytime I tell somebody that they're going to have to I suggest to them that they need to let something go, a belief or anything else, what I tell them, it's a practice. Like you said, Alan, it's like if it's really something you really do need to let go of, you're not going to let go of it once. You're going to let go of it repeatedly for as long as it takes, because what's going to happen is every time you look down at your hand, you're going to be gripping it again. It's like, right. You know, drop it again. It's like, how many times do you have to do that? It's the same thing you've always said about the baby learning to walk. How many times is the baby going to get up? Well, at least one more than he fell down.
Well, your anecdote, Tom, about writing your book, I can really get my head around that, because I feel like I'm engaged in a similar process with my creativity. You know, I'm just wrestling. Yeah. I'm like in conversation with, there's the guy that I need to write it. And then, you know, there's me on the, you know, on the sidelines, just kind of trying to find different ways of bargaining or cajoling or, you know, getting that person to, you know, to get that pen moving. And, you know, it sounds like, you've been at it for a while, you know what I mean? You probably developed some strategies.
One of the things I've learned recently, really gotten become conscious of recently, is that guy that writes, you know, he's completely indifferent to this whole process. He's not the guy that procrastinates. He's the guy that writes when we clear the way for him. I mean, if you clear a place for him to sit down and write, he just writes, you know. And if you don't do it, he doesn't get mad at you. Just, you know, that's, to me, I love that. And that's one of the ways I've learned to differentiate between inner wisdom or, you know, even spiritual wisdom and just ego wisdom, which is basically facing the procrastination. There is a part of me that will remind me as many times as it needs to remind me. It will never get mad. It doesn't get impatient. It just reminds me of the same thing. If you want to get this done, you're going to have to sit down and do it. You know, at no point, although he's been doing it for years, he doesn't come in and say, like, listen, asshole, I've been talking to you about this. It repeats. And it's like, my ego gets in there and does all that stuff, and it just gets in the way. I didn't even think about this as the streamlining part, but it really is. Just get out of the way and let what is wisdom, what is natural, what is part of our spirit, soul, intuition, have a space.
Yes. Yeah, I love it.
I feel an urgency to streamline my thinking now. I don't know, the urgency kind of increases year to year. You know, there was a lot of cobwebs to clear out, obviously, when I started my road to recovery in 2018. Mm-hmm. And I'm pretty busy now. And, you know, luckily the things that I'm busy with, I mean, I'm passionate about a lot of the things that just drain my time and energy, you know, like I really care about them and I want to continue doing them. And so when you talk about streamlining thinking, that's a very appealing concept to me, because it's like, wow, well, how much more time will that free up from, you know, just me getting lost in rabbit holes? And
and the other thing, which you're describing that, what it brings me to, and you, and I think I got this right, and you guys let me know if I'm missing something, but part of the way we get in the way of streamlining is thinking about too much of whatever it is we're doing. Like, I got to work on streamlining, you know. I mean, I have a little line. I've written a little conversation where the teacher says, you know, something to the effect of, you know, all there is the now, be in the now. And the student says, I need to think about that. And the teacher says, no, you don't. That's where we get in the way. We think about this stuff. We can streamline right now. Each one of us, we may lose our place, but we just do it now. This is all I'm doing, is talking to you guys. That's it.
You know, unhealthy obsessions. That's one thing I was thinking about the other days. And, you know, we can count, you know, drinking and drugs as unhealthy obsessions. But then also, there was an ex-girlfriend that I was obsessed with for many years. And her birthday is on my calendar. And it's actually tomorrow. But I had forgotten about this. I hadn't been thinking about her for a while. And then the birthday cropped up on my calendar. And I was just reflecting yesterday on how with time, and I think it's probably been 12 years since I've spoken to her, something like that. So it's, you know, I don't know when this happened, but I hadn't been thinking about it for a while. But so much real estate has been cleared up, you know, in the past few years from me not thinking about somebody that I used to just think about all day, every day, you know what I mean? To the exclusion of all this other important stuff that, you know, could have really helped me.
12 years, you don't even know if this is still her birthday tomorrow.
Right, yeah, it could be. I could be.
You never know.
It's like, yeah. No, but it's similar with, you know, drinking and drugs, you know what I mean? That would be like around the clock, you know, that was a beast that needed to be fed, you know, all the time. And just by taking care of that, you know, through all the ways that we talk about on here, that is about as streamlined as you can get. If I can clear that, just that out, you know what I mean? Then I've got a chance.
But I also think one of the things alcohol did for me, it wasn't worth it because it was connected to all these other things, but it did for me. I probably lived in the moment more when I was drinking, you know, and when I was actually drunk. I wasn't obsessing about other things. I certainly wasn't criticizing myself. You know, maybe I should have been, but it's like, because I think it's interesting to look at how often what we were trying to get with drugs and alcohol. There's nothing, and I had a therapist say this to me one time, there's never anything wrong with what we're trying to get. It's like, it's the way you're getting it. It's like, it's whatever you're trying to get with alcohol or drugs, you need it. Whatever it is, you wouldn't be seeking it. But we need to find a way to do it without being so harmful and so destructive.
That's the key.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes. You know, it was interesting. I was having an interaction with a client who's really getting a lot of help from an IFS therapist, right? Internal family systems therapist. But, you know, it's their take on addiction. I have a problem with, because what he keeps saying is, well, my addict self is protecting me. Well, with friends like that, who needs enemies? Right. I mean, it's great. Yes, it does serve a function in our life. But just like any other thing that compromises our integrity, whether it's our personal values, physical health, anything that compromises us is not a preferred solution. Right?
I mean, people compare, would often ask me if the multiple thing I'm doing is that. And I was like, no, don't mistake it for that. That's an amazing, there's a lot of good stuff in there. But one of the things I always say to differentiate myself from sports stuff is in my model, you're not going to be loving every piece of yourself. You're not just going to be kissing and hugging and integrating everything, because every part of all of that stuff is not all. Each one of those things is not a part of your genuine self. It's like there's a lot of these things that, when we talk about our alcoholism, when you talk about it, to me in my model, I mean, I'm not saying his model doesn't work perfect. It could work too. But my model, tequila boy over there, he's not a part of my genuine self. He is a bot. He's a robot that because he doesn't change. He doesn't adapt. He doesn't change. He just simply says the same thing, goes to the same thing over and over again. My should monster, not part of my, I didn't come with these guys. I wasn't born with these parts of me. These guys are basically metaphors, personifications of programs that we've picked up in our world, and it's like
not all of them get to go on the Apollo mission. Because they're not all ideally suited for that.
That's right. Well, I mean, it's just, and the other piece I get, and I'm doing this eating disorder workshop in a couple of weeks, and this is true for alcoholism, but eating disorders in particular, when you I don't think it's a good idea to tell eating disorders they need to love their eating disorder because these people are, these by history, but mostly I'm generalizing, they're madder than hell. They have no ability to express their anger except at themselves. So every time they try to express anger, it boomerangs and hits them. When I watch people be able to put their eating disorder, we call them Ed or Edie or whatever, out there on that chair, the freedom that comes from when they can actually point their anger at something other than themselves is just phenomenal. It's powerful. It's empowering. And people go, oh, well, you're making them blame something. It's like, no, I just put a thing out online. It's just one of my articles called Don't Blame Ed. We don't blame them, but what we do is we do use them to understand, anger is a good energy. It's a big energy, but you have to be really careful with it because it's dangerous.
I appreciate your distinction with IFS because, the analogy I use to alcoholism that I've stolen from Carl Menninger, he says the alcoholic is like the guy that's on fire who runs out on a pier, jumps off at the end in 20-foot water, and he's on fire. So it feels great when you enter the water. And then he realizes, I don't know how to swim. So it is a... As Tebow said, it's a symptom that has become problematic in itself. And see, these are the things we got to be careful of, is that we don't solve a problem. Like if my leg hurts, I don't put my hand on the table and pick up a hammer and smash my hand. Yeah, I'm not going to worry about my leg after that, but I got a broken hand. I mean, that's not an optimal solution. We want something that's going to...
We can do better.
We can do better. Yes. But see, that stuff, when you're doing that stuff, that is unconsciously driven. Because everyone, yep. If they really looked at it and they saw it, they'd say, oh my God, what am I doing to myself? And see, that's where it's so interesting how addiction hijacks the brain. And the recent studies that I've been looking at with it, Tom, is they used to think that it just hijacked the pleasure center, right? The amygdala.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If you are out there listening to this and you wonder where the amygdala is, put two fingers over on the center of your eyebrow, mm-hmm. two fingers over your ear, mm-hmm. and then think of where they intersect in the center of your head. Right? Yeah, yeah. That's where your amygdala is or your pleasure center, right? Right deep inside the brain. So they used to say, well, it hijacked that. Well, recently they realize that the whole brain is hijacked. It's not just the pleasure center. Your judgment, the frontal lobes are hijacked. I mean, your motor strips are hijacked. It takes complete control of who we are. And so that's why when we go to pick up and use, like I've got a client right now, he had a good run of sobriety and this relationship ended and his tequila boy talked him into, few tequilas will be fine right now. And he's off.
This will work.
That's the thing. It can convince us because it takes over our judgment and it clouds our judgment.
Right. Well, see, I can take this back to my intrapersonal model too. It's like, so the idea is what we're trying, the only reason we're identifying to me, we're identifying all these other characters because one of my little nutshells says beneath everyone beneath who you are not, you will find who you are. So it's an excavation. You're going through there and you find this in the good, bad, and whatever they're there. What we're looking for, and none of us had it at the beginning of any whatever our process is. We're looking for, and you can call it whatever you want to, but I call it in embracing fear or something. I call it the decision maker. It's like you're looking for that part that is that conscious intelligence that will look at that, like it gets a chance to look. When you're on fire, you go jump off a pier. Oh, that's not good.
It's kind of like you're trying to get the president to read your letter. You're trying to get the decision maker to alert to
he doesn't even read.
Yeah. Right. Earlier president.
You know, that's what we're striving for, is to get this to be our natural response to a situation.
That's thank you. You've added to my streamlined thing. That's exactly it. It's the forward punch, or it's whatever it is. It's, and in this case, thinking is, we consider thinking much like we think of behavior. You know, you have to repeat the behavior. You have to repeat the thought. And then it becomes natural. That's the only way I got to the place where I could get kicked in the stomach by a horse.
I was saying, I get upset right now. I want to blame the other person, but I can't get away with it anymore. It's like that well has been poisoned.
Yeah, yeah.
To think about blaming them, I start to say, wait a minute, hold on. You know, the second thought comes in.
Right. But it's like, I always say, it's like find the hidden picture in Highlights magazine. That's what awareness is. Once you see it, shit, yeah. I can't not see it now.
That's right. You know? That's good analogy, man.
Yeah, yeah.